Welcome back to On Air with Israel Fair and Alex Blair.
Joining us on air this week is Dave Pratt. Hello, Dave. Thanks for taking the time to do this.
And thanks for having me.
All right, let's get right into it. The Vancouver Canucks, an unbelievable up and down season, the COVID season. There's going to be a lot of things that people remember from this crazy year. For you, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Well, I think the way that the season ended for them, Adam Gaudette getting it in his head that it was okay to go and party his ass off with his little buddies and then walk into the dressing room with COVID is beyond anything. I've seen some crazy, crazy stuff in this business over the years, but nothing like this. It just absolutely ended their season, and it's too bad because it's also going to cost head coach Travis Green his job. There are going to be changes in the offseason, and the first guy that's going to be out the door is Travis Green, and that's too bad because I like Travis Green. I think he's a coach's coach. I think he's done some amazingly good things with this organization. He doesn't deserve to take the fall for it, but in this game, it's not about what's right or wrong. It's all about, you know, winning and losing. And when you lose, somebody pays the price, and it's usually the head coach. And I think that Travis Green ultimately is going to be out of a job.
If changes need to be made, David, should it be Travis Green or should it be higher up the ladder and general manager Jim Benning, who's finishing up his seventh year in charge of this organization?
Ultimately, the responsibility goes with your general manager, and that's why I point a finger at Jim Benning, but that is not how it's going to happen. Jim Benning's still got two more years left in his contract, and in this game, when things don't work out, you fire the head coach. Travis Green has a contract that's about to run out on him, and this is the easier way to go. They will fire Travis Green at the end of the season, which is too bad, because I like Travis Green. He's a coach's coach, gets it, and it shouldn't be on him, but that's not, as I said before, the way this game is played, and Travis Green will be fired at the end of the season.
One of the narratives that has arisen over the course of this year is that the Aquilinis and the Aquilini family have been particularly hit by the pandemic financially, and they have lowered costs. There has been a number of layoffs across the organization. There is a belief that this sort of standoff with Travis Green is over money. And if Travis Green is to not re-sign with the Canucks, that they will look to find a cheaper, less expensive option. When you look at the coaching hire, do you see the Canucks getting a big name, or do you see them potentially going on the cheap if they do move on from Travis Green?
I think that they've got to go after a big name. And there are a number of big names that are out there because your head coach is so much the face of your franchise. He's the guy who's got to deal with the media every single day. And take a look at the guys that are available right now. Gerard Gallant is available. I mean, Claude Julien's out there. Mike Babcock is available out there. I mean, again, you're talking about big names. Bruce Boudreau, there's a lot of that out there for them in terms of finding some sort of a brand that they can sell. But having said that, it's one thing for us in the media to go and speculate, but how many times do we sit back and go, WTF, what just happened here? They hired who? So those are my thoughts. Do I think it's actually going to happen? Wait and see. be ready to be surprised.
You just listed a bunch of big name coaches there, Dave. As of April 30th, the Seattle Kraken, officially the 32nd team in the NHL. That means that they can start signing players, start making trades. We'll have the expansion draft in a couple of months as well that people around the league have been anticipating for a long time. And they don't have a head coach yet. So Travis Green, if he's not with the Canucks, Seattle a fit? Or do you see them maybe going, they got a lot of options, that's for sure.
Yeah. No. I think that your general manager, Ron Francis, is smart enough to know that he needs to go and get himself a name. And the names that we just threw out there, and on the top of the list is obviously Gerard Gallant. I mean, you go take a look at, you know, what he did in Vegas. He's going to be coming back from the World Juniors. No, he's the guy that I honestly believe is going to be the new head coach in Seattle. And Ron Francis is smart enough to understand that because not only is it a good hockey move, it's also a good business move. So do I want to give, you know, the curse of a Pratt guarantee? Sure, I'll do it. I guarantee it. Gerard Gallant's
there. There it is.
There you go.
I did want to ask you about Seattle as someone who, you know, spent a huge portion of their career in sports talk radio in Vancouver. Yep. I think it's often overlooked how isolated Vancouver is out here, sort of on the West Coast, west side of the Rocky Mountains. And they've, you know, as much as there's been rivalries with Calgary, there's sort of a national rivalry with Toronto. There hasn't been a very geographic rival. And I'm just wondering the significance of that through your eyes, and also the positive impact that it could have on an organization like Vancouver and the Canucks, holding them to a higher standard, holding them to, you know, be better than maybe they've had to be in the past because there's a team just down the road that's doing it the right way. Just curious to your perspective on that.
Well, there's always going to be pressure to win. That's the business of professional sports. But the economic benefit of having a geographical rival, go take a look at the best rivalries in sports. And in hockey, the classic one is just, you know, on the other side of the Rockies, you know, the Battle of Alberta. For this organization to have gone over 50 years without having that geographical rival is truly amazing. I mean, you sit back and say, okay, who is the Canucks' biggest rival? And it didn't matter which team you would go and pick, okay, because of a playoff run, you know, it doesn't really matter. The fans in that city don't see it the same way. Yeah. And that's the great thing about a rivalry. It has to work both sides for it to actually be a true rivalry. So to get Seattle is absolutely amazing from a business point of view, but for a fan point of view as well. Keep in mind, the last time they had a rival in Seattle was over 100 years ago. That's amazing. And most fans in the city don't even realize that, you know, Seattle with the Metropolitans won a Stanley Cup in 1917 and the Vancouver Millionaires won a Stanley Cup in 1915, over 100 years ago. So it's there and they'll play with it as much as they can because it's the cosmetics. But look, economically, you couldn't ask for more. The only thing they've got to do now in Seattle is actually build themselves an NHL arena.
As we head into a summer where there is a sense that change could be coming, I wanted to ask you about ownership of the Canucks. This is a family that has been part owners going back to the early 2000s. They took over full ownership sort of near the end of the Dave Nonis era. And they've made two significant changes within the organization. The first bringing in Mike Gillis in 2008, which at the time was a fairly unconventional hire. And then they brought in Trevor Linden to replace Mike Gillis in 2014. They've never really opened it up to a quote unquote public search or executive search. They've always sort of had someone in mind, and both times they've gone non-traditional or not sort of what would be a highly touted candidate. Your thoughts on this ownership group and how important their sort of charting a course is at this stage of the franchise.
Well, I think that they're going to stay pretty much, you know, on track with where they've been going, because general manager Jim Benning is not leaving. He's got 2 years left on his contract and he's not going to be leaving anytime soon. And keep in mind, and here's the crazy part about Jim Benning, with all of his history with scouting, go take a look at the draft picks that they've had over the last few years with Pettersson and Besser and Hughes and now Hoglander and all of it. So from a rebuilding process, they've gone and done it the right way. Unfortunately, they go and fire their head scout, which to me, I can't rationalize that in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, right now, Jim Benning still has a job and 2 years left on his contract to get this thing done. And that's the way that they're going to go with it. The guy who's going to pay the price for missing the playoffs this year is going to be their head coach.
Going back to the bubble, you know, great series with Minnesota, upset St. Louis, push Vegas to seven. This season, yeah, obviously has not been the success that I think a lot of fans were hoping to see. When you see the team on the ice and taking into account management and ownership, how far away do you think this team is from a Stanley Cup?
At least, and this is, again, if they get the pieces in place, they're at least 2 or 3 years away from taking a legitimate run at the Cup. And like I said, the core pieces that they have are very, very good, especially now that we actually found out that Brock Besser can go play a whole season and stay healthy and stay in the lineup. Didn't know that was possible. So at the end of the day, they've got some nice pieces, but they've got a lot more heavy lifting to do. And at the end of the day, what they cannot do is make the same mistake they've made in the past, and that's to try to fast track it. There is only one way to win a Stanley Cup in a league that is controlled by salary cap, and that is through the draft. You have to be patient. And that's the thing that this organization from ownership has not had, that patience that's required to go and pay the price. And if they're not willing to do it, they're not going to win a Stanley Cup. But at least they've got some nice pieces to start with.
We had the anniversary earlier this week of the famous Alex Burrows Slay the Dragon goal. This was something that you had a front row seat for as sort of the voice of Vancouver sports in Vancouver. 10 years on from that run in 2011, I'm just wondering sort of your strongest memories, how you look back on that era of Canucks hockey, the things that come to mind, and maybe with time and hindsight, how much differently you view that or the appreciation level you have for that era of the Canucks.
Well, I think what it does, again, it reminds me of how great these fans are. If we could only, you know, go through a Stanley Cup run and not hold a riot, you know, that would be nice. If we could just do that, get to a cup final, not riot, actually win it, and then have a parade and not a riot.
Baby steps, Dave, baby steps.
Okay. You say, let's just get back to the dance first, and then we'll figure out, you know, what kind of a party that we're going to have. Do you know what I would really like to see? I would really like to see this. I would love to see Alex Burrows as a head coach here in Vancouver.
That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, he's an assistant right now with the Montreal Canadiens, as you know. But he is just one of those great icons who leads with his heart. The fans love him. He is now, you know, on a path to become a head coach in the NHL somewhere. And I think that he's going to make a great head coach. And I would love to see that happen right here in Vancouver.
Well, to your point on that, his name has been floated a little bit this week in the sense that as an inexperienced assistant coach in his first year, he would not demand a big ticket. And if financial, you know, the compensation that a new head coach is going to require is a factor for ownership, he would be potentially
absolutely
an underpriced candidate that you could sell to this fan base.
Well, the thing is that you have to win. And Alex Burrows right now is just beginning to learn the craft of coaching. If you could get him and give him a job, you know, that is one step higher up than an assistant coach, that would put him in a position to become a head coach. In other words, two steps to become a head coach as opposed to just one, then I think maybe you can attract him. But at the end of the day right now, what the Canucks need is an experienced NHL coach who knows how to come in here and right this ship. And as we were talking about earlier, there are some serious names that are available out there, big names. But the thing with those big names, especially with Gerard Gallant on the top of that list, is they're also going to want a long-term contract with big money. So there's the X factor that gets played into it. As much as we can sit here and move these pieces around the chessboard, the Aquilinis are the guys that are going to want actually have to, you know, write the check. So do I see Alex Burrows eventually winding up as a coach here in Vancouver? Absolutely. This is home for Alex Burrows.
You mentioned the fans, Dave. In 2011, the Canucks fans were, you know, in full force. But going back 10 years, that was a pretty good year for the BC Lions. They won the Grey Cup. And that was a pretty exciting time for a soccer fan in Vancouver because the Whitecaps made the jump to Major League Soccer. There was a lot of excitement about those two teams in particular. Here we are 10 years later with the pandemic. The Whitecaps have not played a game in Vancouver in quite some time. We have no idea when the Lions are going to be playing a game of any kind after having the entire CFL season wiped out. When you look at where those two organizations and franchises in the city are at, what do you anticipate is in their future?
Well, first and foremost, with the Whitecaps, they have got solid ownership with very deep pockets, and they are playing in a league that is established. They're not going anywhere, and they're going to be just fine. The way that they've handled it, terrific. Got it. I have no concerns in terms of the future of the Whitecaps and the league that they're playing in and all of it. The Lions are a much different story. The CFL is in serious trouble. I know that all the talk with the XFL, but the XFL is no magical answer. I mean, if you just want to go and Google the XFL and then find out exactly all the dysfunctionality that's going along with that, it's just bizarre. But having said that, the CFL is a great concern to me because as a kid growing up, I grew up as a CFL fan. And to see this league in the situation that it's in right now, can I see the league folding? Absolutely. I know that they're kicking their season back, trying to buy some time. But and they've got 5 years left, I understand, you know, with TSN and all of that. But the league is in an absolute critical stage. And if they don't get it right and fix it in a hurry, this league will fold.
On the CFL, it's clear the pandemic has had a huge financial impact on businesses, sports franchises, leagues, you know, businesses outside of sports. But I am curious to know, did you see the CFL being in long-term trouble prior to the pandemic, just in the direction they were headed?
Oh, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the thing with the CFL, when you go take a look at their fan base, it's plus 50.
Yeah.
Their inability to connect with that younger demographic, okay, is just beyond me. And here's the thing that frustrates the hell out of me when it comes to the CFL is that they don't seem to understand that professional sports is 12 months a year. There is no such thing as an off season in professional sports. They disappear. They play that Grey Cup game they played in 2019 was spectacular.
Yep.
I mean, unbelievable game. You know, it was the halftime show couldn't have been better. I mean, the celebration, the crowd, all of it. The CFL is a great game. They've got a solid fan base, okay? But that fan base is plus 50. And if they don't go and do the things that are necessary to attract that younger demographic and play by their rules, okay, which is 52 weeks a year to keep them engaged, the CFL will not survive.
The Lions, when I was a kid, were a big part of the consciousness. And that's not too long ago, you know, through the 2000s with Damon Allen and Dave Dickinson and the Wally Buono era, if you will. And I had lots of friends who are in their late 20s, early 30s now who love the CFL. And they have completely fallen off. And they watch the NFL now. They love football, but they're attracted to the NFL because it's such a good television product. And it's got the storylines and the stars and the heroes and the goats and go down the list that they've got great television programming. And while I think across the country, the CFL numbers are still pretty good, especially when the Rough Riders play, they failed in this market to capitalize on people that were invested as young people. They did not give them a reason to stick around.
Single biggest issue for the CFL are the two largest markets in Canada. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we start with Toronto. And then it's Vancouver. How can you have a market the size of Toronto and zero fans at your games with the Argos? And again, it gets back to what we're talking about. Their inability to market their product is beyond anything that I've ever seen, ever. And is it about getting a new commissioner? That would be a very good step. They've got a great business partner, you know, with Bell and TSN and all the things that go along with it. Glenn Suter is a very good friend of mine. You will not find a better color guy, a better salesman, a better pitch man for all of this kind of stuff. They've got some great pieces there. But man, oh man, until they go and fix, you know, their commissioner and get a guy in there who sees the vision that's required with it. And you go take a look at the NFL. You've got a blueprint of how you do it. I mean, geez. It amazes me that this league that I grew up with is going down the path that it's going on. And it will be a very sad day for me and a lot of other football fans in this country if the CFL folds. But if they don't fix it, and I mean fix it in a hurry, they could be gone within a year.
I sense that you're not a big believer in the potential merger with the XFL. But given everything that you've just said and the problems marketing this game, selling this game to a younger audience, is there any upside to the XFL potential merger there for you as far as marketing, the way they display that game? Do you see this being a Hail Mary?
Here's the thing is that the XFL has the potential to be a really good business partner for the CFL. But I think that the mistake that a lot of fans are making, and I think a lot of people in the media are making, is that the idea that, well, we cut the deal with the XFL, all our problems are solved. No, they're not. You still have got to get these fans back into these seats. This is a league that is completely fan dependent. Their television deal with, you know, with Bell is an absolute lifesaver for them right now. Yeah. But you've got to get butts in seats. And that's got to get back to each individual team doing the things that they have to do 12 months out of the year. As I said before, it's not a 6-month season. That's not how professional sports operates. It's 52 weeks. It just drives me nuts that this league literally disappears for 6 months a year. Crazy.
Something that Alex and I talk about quite a bit on the show, Dave, is the changing media landscape, especially in sports. And we're seeing a big change in the U.S. when it comes to the national TV broadcasters. ESPN's back in the game this week. Confirmation that Turner Sports, most well-known for broadcasting the NBA, has come in as an NHL partner. Won't necessarily affect most of the people that listen to us and that follow the Canucks, but it's still a pretty significant move for the NHL to go in that different direction, move away from NBC, who they'd been with since the 2004-05 lockout. Do you anticipate that they might actually take some chances, try to do some things differently, try to be a little bit more entertaining than the product that they've put together to this point?
Well, the entertainment aspect of it obviously is critical because they're in the entertainment business. But the actual economics that you're talking about, it is, you know, what Gary Bettman is all about. Do you want to know why he's still the commissioner of the NHL? Because he does the one thing that every commissioner gets paid to do, and that's put money into the pockets of the owners. That's it. He only has one job, put money into the pockets of the owners. And no commissioner in the entire history of the NHL has done what Gary Bettman has done. Is he popular with the fans? No, doesn't matter. Where the Stanley Cup is presented, he always gets booed. Always, got it, understand it. But the owners love him because he understands the business. And that's where Gary Bettman's background and all of it that is connected with it. This is a business. The CFL has to figure that out or they just simply will not survive.
In regards to media, it's been a very quick and very fast changing landscape. As somebody who spent the better part of a couple of decades in the business in Vancouver, I'm really curious to know your perspectives on what you've seen over the last couple of years here and how quickly the decline has taken place.
Amazing, to say the least. The thing that you have to understand about the broadcast industry is that it's a retail business. And the entertainment business, which is what Sports Talk Radio, which is what you're doing right now, is something that is only successful if you are going to make, you know, that move to be sort of the next Bruce Allen. Let's go and find the talent and then go and make the money with it and be willing to go and manage the talent. The broadcast industry is, at the end of the day, retail. And when the economics don't add up, what's the first thing that a retail company will do? They will cut back and cut back and cut back. Right. And that's what we're seeing. Social media, the explosion. I mean, there are 2 million podcasts out there. But at the end of the day, it's the wild, wild west. And that is not what the broadcast industry is. It has always been about going to the CRTC and getting the license, mm-hmm. a license that was always considered like a ticket to print money. And that no longer is the case because of the technology that goes along with it. And I'll close it by simply saying this, that in this business, as in life, technology is either your best friend or it's your worst enemy. So it's simple to do the math once you've done that.
You mentioned the word talent there, and that's something I wanted to ask you about because one of the things that I've noticed across the industry is that it has tended to be, or I shouldn't say tended to be, but a lot of the marquee big talent, the people that have driven ratings but have also you know, had a fairly high salary have been the ones to be cut. I think it's fair to say that, you know, one of your departures from 1040 here was it was over a contract negotiation to some degree. When you get back to the whole idea of talent and entertainment and drawing an audience, it seems like the industry is sort of cutting themselves at the knees by removing some of those personalities and some of those people that are larger than life that really drive the ratings. Just sort of a general thought on sort of the decimation of top talent across the industry.
Well, I think it's just the difference is who now owns the companies. The broadcast industry, you know, for 100 years was basically family-owned businesses. And now it's owned by companies and corporations. It's just the way that the industry has changed structurally. So the families that I used to work for are gone, and the kids that you know got the companies, they sold it to corporations, and the very fundamentals of the industry have changed, and it just is what it is, and it's bizarre. I mean, to woken up a few days ago and to hear 1040 suddenly just go off the air and start playing comedy albums. If somebody had asked me, you know, did Stephen King write this novel too? I would have said, you're out of your mind. That will never, ever happen. I mean, are you guys nuts? You guys have been drinking too much? What's going on here? And that's exactly what happened. So it is the business of the business. And if you want to find the truth, follow the money.
You spent a good chunk of the latter part of your career at 1040 and in a variety of roles on, you know, a couple of really well-known shows. When that news came down, what was your reaction?
It was a real WTF, okay? Because I'd heard about it and then I went online and I'm listening to this, right? And I went, did this just really happen? Because I can remember when Chum launched, you know, their network of stations, right? Mm-hmm. They went through a similar situation where they shut down a bunch of the stations that weren't working. But the one thing that was great about 1040 is that, you know, we had put a hit show together, an afternoon drive that was, you know, making money and all the other things that went along with it. And not only did we survive, you know, that shakeup, but then we went and got the Canucks and all the other things that went along with it.
Yep.
So you're thinking, okay, you know, as long as we're going down this road and we're having success, great. But the difference between corporations and family-owned businesses are a little different. And it just is what it is. And it's the ability to adapt. And this is what we're doing right now with this particular interview. Would have been unthinkable 10 years ago that we're actually doing an interview this way. So more than anything else, the future of our business is going to be continually connected to how we interact with the new technologies and grow from it. That's the future, and that's where the money is.
Over the course of your career, Dave, what part of being in media, being in broadcasting, do you miss that has changed, and what do you think is the evolution that has been the most beneficial?
What I miss are the characters. The thing about our industry for the last, literally the last 100 years has been that there have been some wild, wild characters that I've had the privilege to work with, and great people. The good, the bad, the ugly, all of it. It was, to say the least, and has continued to be incredibly entertaining. But again, the one thing that as we adapt is that you have to be much more politically correct in so many different ways, both on and off the air. That's the one thing that I kind of roll my eyes at and go, okay, got it, okay. And it is what it is. I can remember when we first launched 1040, I got a phone call from Brian Burke, and he was mad at me, yelling and screaming at me about something. I don't even know what it was anymore. And I phoned up my GM, and I said, Brian Burke just picked a fight with me. Do you mind if I go on the air and have some fun with it? And he said, no, go ahead. So we went on the air and took a shot back at Brian Burke, and away we go. And next thing I know, Jennifer's on the air, but that was all part of being a family run business, that you could do stuff like that. Corporately now, to do that, go down that road, not a chance.
Yeah, it actually gets back to my thought on the topic of talent. And as you touched on, characters were such a big part of that. Yes. And taking chances, you were someone that walked a fairly tight line at times. But when you see the events of, you know, the last year and a half, and I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, in like the Don Cherry saga, for example. But I think, you know, whether you agreed with Don or you disagreed with Don, you wanted to watch Don for the most part. He was entertaining to a degree. And do you get the sense that there's a fear of this cancel culture right now, where you know, if you step out of line, there's not sort of an understanding of, you know, occasionally we're going to cross a line and we may need to apologize, that type of thing. It's just, you make a mistake, you're out the door. And that sort of has people running scared a little bit.
Well, understand that it's a corporate mentality, okay? And if you're working within a corporation, you need to know, you know, where the lines are always, okay? But sports talk radio, and if you want to talk about Don Cherry, again, another example of it, the whole idea of it is that we're in the entertainment business. Well, the idea of being in the entertainment business is to stir the pot. You want to get people emotionally invested in your show. So you've got a good cop, you've got a bad cop. And what I have found over the many years that I've been doing this, it is infinitely more fun to be the bad cop. And those guys that were not afraid to be the bad cop were the guys that you're always talking about, and Don Cherry would be on the top of the list. But it was understood that it was done with a twinkle in the eye. And as long as it was done that way, that you understand that this is how Hollywood works. I mean, try to imagine Star Wars without Darth Vader. Really? Okay, you just got a bunch of spaceships flying around bumping into each other. Throw Darth Vader in there, and now you've got a $1 billion enterprise. It's the entertainment business. And corporations, you would think, would learn from Hollywood, but that's really not the way that it's structured. Politically, it doesn't work like that. So you just have to be much more politically aware of what you can and what you cannot say.
As we see an industry where salaries are on the decline, and we see a city like Vancouver where the cost of living is on the rise, I'm curious, when was the peak financial era of being a media member in Vancouver?
Oh, probably 10 years ago. Yeah, and I think that's it gets back to what we were just talking about again, the ownership of the companies and all of that. A time when media companies would bid for talent, okay? So if you were doing really well over working for this radio television company or whatever it is, it was not unusual for the other company to come after you and make you an offer. Those days are long gone. Like I said, probably about 10 years ago when it peaked out, and then the corporation sort of took over, and it just became more like a business. I think that's probably as close as I can get.
When you look back on all the things that you've done over your career, Dave, what stands out to you as making you the most proud?
There's some great moments to it all. But I think the single proudest moment I had was getting my very first job in Vancouver at the ripe old age of 20 years of age, to walk in to the very powerful CKLG back then, and the CKLG FM, which is now CFOX, to walk in there as a kid and to be able to have the privilege to work with a great guy like Kerry Marshall. That was the single defining moment. And then from there, everything just kind of worked out. And it was also pretty good that I got a phone call from Jim Van Horn telling me about this TSN company that was just launching, and would I be interested in doing some television there? And I went, yeah, let's do that. So those are probably the two moments that I look back and say with a smile on my face, yeah, it kind of worked out.
Was that the studio on Richards, the CKLG, Dave?
Yes, 1006 Richards Street, right down from Richards on Richards. And it was the 80s. It was,
Well, as we chatted the other night, we had a mutual friend in the late Kerry Marshall, who passed away a couple of summers ago, and I know he was a mentor for you, and he was someone that was a father of one of my good friends growing up, but also took me under his wing as I got into broadcasting as well, and just a terrific guy. I am curious about the transition. We talked on 1040. I'm curious about the transition for you from TSN to 1040 and what that looked like. Did you go from one to the other, or was there a transition period in between?
Oh no, the situation with 1040 is that it came along at the time when TSN canceled our studios because Dave Randorf and I were anchoring the national desk. I don't know, 6-7 years, whatever it is, we were doing all of that, and shut that down. And it was sort of like, okay, where are we going to go from here? Because you're not going to pay me what you're paying me right now to do some reporting and post game and stuff like that.
Right.
But at the same time, 1040 launched. I mean, literally at the exact same time. So it was an instant move. And again, it was a phone call. Next thing I know, we're doing afternoon drive at 1040, and we took it to number one.
I did want to ask you, because you worked with a few people. The first show I remember you doing was with you and the Moj. It was the afternoon show. I know Donnie would appear as a fairly regular. But I did want to ask you about some of the people that you worked with through the time that would be familiar to our audience. The first one that comes to mind is the Moj. And I'm just wondering what you remember about that show and also just working with Bob and the dynamic between the two of you.
Well, I'd known Bob before, right? And what I like about the Moj is that he's a character. He's a personality. Love him or hate him, whatever it is. And I love working with people like that. The thing with Moj is that he was ambitious and wanted, you know, his opportunity to go and really, you know, be a star in the game, right? Mm-hmm. And those are the guys that will survive in this kind of an industry, and they will find ways to succeed. There's a difference between entertainers and broadcasters. You know, broadcasters, you know, will read scores, fine, got it, teleprompter. Entertainers will push the envelope, and the Moj was a guy who liked to push the envelope, still does.
I'll follow that up with Donnie Taylor, who's probably, if not the most recognizable broadcaster, sort of from the Vancouver scene. He's got to be right there on sort of the Mount Rushmore. Obviously someone that you would have known as well, but you guys had a long run together and you guys had a very successful run. Just sort of the dynamic with you and Donnie.
Well, Don, along with Jim Van Horn, in my opinion, are the two best sports anchors in the history of Canadian broadcasting, period. They have a likability to camera that is beyond belief. And you know, I appreciate that because it's not something that comes naturally to me. It's just that's not my character. I'm much more of the love hate kind of guy. I want to stir the pot. Likeability to me is just not what's up. But when you're selling highlights, you have to understand that the highlights are the star of the show and you're selling them, which means your audience has got to like you. It's like any salesman. It doesn't matter what you're selling. If they don't like you, they're not going to buy what you're selling. It doesn't matter. Cars, real estate, doesn't matter. And Don Taylor and Jim Van Horn are the two best sports anchors in the history of Canadian broadcasting. I was very privileged to work with both of them.
What I remember about Pratt and Taylor was the simulcast on television. How did that evolution come to pass where you just mentioned you were at TSN, they shut down the studios, you go over, you work at 1040, and 1040 was a success in this market, maybe not immediately, but it was obviously the 20-year legacy looking back. There was some staying power there, and all of a sudden you and Donnie are doing a radio show on television. What was that like?
The thing is, it was a great, great move because anything that drives your profile, especially television, is going to drive your ratings. So all of that, from a business point of view, it was absolutely great. But the great thing about doing radio, as you know, is you don't have to get dressed up to do it. You can have a baseball hat and put it on backwards and no one's going to say anything.
It's like you're looking at me right now, Dave.
And that's the one thing I've always loved about radio is that there's a real informality that goes along with it, right? You can show up with your t-shirt and your baseball cap on backwards and everything's great. Whereas television, you have to understand is that you've got to go and understand the cosmetics of television. I anchored the national desk for I don't know how many years for TSN, and it was a job because you're selling highlights. Sports talk radio was fun because you got to stir the pot. Like I said, in terms of Don Taylor, easily one of the top two sports anchors in Canadian broadcast history, period.
Some people won't know this. I came up and had the opportunity. My first job was at CTV Sports in Vancouver, which at that point had the affiliation with TSN. And so I got to work fairly closely with Farhan Lalji as sort of a young guy. And he, I remember at the time, sort of reflected back on being a young guy working under you coming up and talked a little bit about the 94 run. I'm just curious about what you remember about a young Farhan and, you know, sort of the sort of what he's grown into as a broadcaster as well.
Well, the thing with Farhan is that he really wanted it. I don't know how well you know Farhan. I gave him his first job. And the reason I gave him the first job is for the exactly what you're just talking about. He's a guy that really, really wanted to do this and was willing to do the heavy lifting and the hard work to make it happen. And when I left TSN to go full time at 1040, he replaced me and is still there. Mm-hmm. So it has worked out absolutely fantastic for him. But don't kid yourself for a second. The one thing that Farhan does, and a lot of it doesn't get to camera, but he does all the hard work behind the scenes and has grown his own brand in his own way.
Yeah, and been a big proponent for football along the way, which I know is obviously really close to his heart. Last one for me, Dave, and this has been really enjoyable. One of your sort of trademarks was Pratt's Rant, and I'm just curious if you had to kind of come on Monday and encapsulate sort of what you'd want to talk about or what you would choose to rant about. I'm just curious the topic that would sort of pull on your heart at this point in time in the Vancouver sports market.
Well, I think it gets back to where we started talking about right off the kick of this thing, and that has to do with what the Canucks are going to do with their head coach. It frustrates me because it's so easy to go and fire a head coach at the end of a disappointing season. And is it fair? No. Is it reality? Yes. That would be my rant. And somewhere along the line, I would work in Adam Gaudette into the equation, because think about this for a second. You've got a player who decides to go party his ass off, brings COVID into the room, and you're the head coach and you get fired. Okay. Yeah, I got it. Gaudette got traded, but you got fired. And, the unfortunate part about the entertainment business or in business period, things happen. Does it make it right? No. Is it fair? No. But it is reality, and it is our business, and the wheel keeps turning.
Dave, thanks a lot for coming on. I will say, for me, doing some hits with you over the years when you had the morning show at 1040 was a great privilege. I enjoyed it a lot. It was a huge opportunity for me, so I was very appreciative of all those opportunities as well. And yeah, thanks for jumping on with us. Really enjoyed the conversation.
And thanks for having me.
You're listening to the On Air Podcast with Israel Fair and Alex Blair.